Previously on Beta.
Rest of the book, To Serve Men, it's a cookbook.
That's not fair. That's not fair at all.
Willoughby, hold on for Willoughby. Willoughby, stop is Willoughby.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Do you think all video games are pretty much the same? Well, think again.
What a video game is as various as like what a piece of music is. You know, you wouldn't call like a bluegrass banjo song the Hamilton soundtrack and Nessun Dorma. Those are all pieces of music, but you know, they don't have a hell of a lot in common.
Tom Bissell talks about playing and writing video games. And have you ever heard an album that seemed like it was recorded just for you? Jonathan Lethem has.
I felt so at odds with everybody and everything, and the album seemed to create an image of powerful response to being disempowered that I wanted to make my own.
Lethem will join us to talk about one of his touchstone albums, Talking Heads' Fear of Music. And we'll explore the evolution of the cell phone ringtone, which involves a guy named Thomas Morgan Robertson. And you probably already know who he is.
One of the things that he actually helped produce was this ability to create polyphonic ringtones or multi-toned ringtones through the use of software.
She blinded me with silence.
We'll find out who he is a bit later. But we're going to get things started with Carmen Maria Machado. Machado's debut short story collection is called Her Body and Other Parties. It was a finalist for the National Book Award. Carmen's stories map the realities of women's lives and the violence that is visited upon their bodies. These stories destroy the boundaries between psychological realism and fantasy. Her stories may remind you of Kelly Link's fiction, and that's not surprising since Carmen says that reading Link's short story collection, Magic for Beginners, totally rearranged her DNA.
Before I read Magic for Beginners, I didn't really have a sense of, like, I sort of knew what I wanted to write about as a writer. I feel like to be a writer, you need to figure out, like, what it is that you want to say with your work and also how you want to do it. And I sort of knew what I wanted to write about. Like, I knew that I had this interest in gender and sexuality and, like, these were things I wanted to write about. But I had no sense of my style or what mode of telling would sort of most serve these ambitions. And so when I read Magic for Beginners, I remember thinking to myself, like, it's this, you know, really sort of giddy mix of metafiction and sort of genre mashing. It's like horror and fantasy and science. It's like everything.
Yeah, and hasn't it been described, I think maybe not by Kelly Link, but by one of her critics as kitchen sink surrealism?
Oh, I don't think I've ever heard that expression, but that totally makes sense.
Something like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's different kinds of ways to think about genre, and one of them, right, is like these sort of sets of rules and tropes. But the thing about Kelly Link's work and the writing that I most love is that it sort of moves very freely between these categories and sort of defies these sort of, yeah, these easy sort of boxes. And Kelly's work did that, and I remember reading it thinking, you can do that? You can do that? What? And there was something so freeing about that. And I remember returning to my work that I was working on at the time and suddenly having a sense of how I wanted to tell my, not my story, but like how I wanted to write my stories, like how I wanted to tell them. And then everything kind of just opened up after that in this way that was really amazing. So I'd say she helped me like find my voice, I guess.
Yeah. The first story in your book, Her Body and Other Parties, is called The Husband Stitch. Where did the inspiration for this story come from?
I have an aunt who is an OBGYN nurse, and one time years ago, I guess when I was in grad school, I was visiting my family and I was chatting with her, and she mentioned this phrase, the husband stitch, which I had never heard before. And I said, you know, what is that? And she was like, well, you know, women come in, give birth, they have episiotomies, and then when they're getting sort of stitched back up, the husbands will sort of jokingly ask for this like extra stitch to tighten them up. And I was like, well, that's the most horrifying thing I've ever heard in my entire life. But the phrase, the husband stitch, had this sort of poetry to it that I found very compelling. And so I just sort of jotted it down. And I do a lot of note taking and list making for ideas. So oftentimes when I'm writing stories, I'm sort of filtering through, I'm digging through my lists, seeing if there's something in there that I've already thought of that might complement the idea that I'm having in some way. So I had also sort of separately had an idea about retelling the urban legend of the girl with the green ribbon around her neck, which I had read as a child and had really affected me. And then I also separately had an idea about a woman, sort of a mid-century housewife who really enjoys sex. And then I separately had an idea about writing a story about urban legends in general and sort of myths and you know, something very Angela Carter-esque, I guess, was what I was thinking. And so when I sat down, I was up in this cabin and I was like doing some work and I was looking through all my notes and I was like, oh, like these pieces all connect to each other. This title and concept, these two women are sort of the same person. And I sort of just like realized that I had been writing the story, you know, over a couple of years. I had sort of jotted down these like major points in my lists and then I just sort of drew them together and the rest is history.
Now would be the perfect time to have you read an excerpt from The Husband's Ditch. And could you set it up if you think it needs setup?
Oh, yeah. So I'm reading a little bit into the very beginning of the story, and the protagonist has just sort of explained to the reader that she's met this boy at a party as a young woman and that she's very attracted to him. I have imagined a lot of things in the dark, in my bed, beneath the weight of that old quilt, but never this, and I moan. When he pulls away, he seems startled. His eyes dart around for a moment before settling on my throat. "What's that?" he asks. "Oh, this." I touch the ribbon at the back of my neck. "It's just my ribbon." I run my fingers halfway around its green and glossy length and bring them to rest on the tight bow that sits in the front. He reaches out his hand, and I seize it and press it away. "You shouldn't touch it," I say. "You can't touch it." Before we go inside, he asks if he can see me again. I tell him that I would like that. That night before I sleep, I imagine him again, his tongue pushing open my mouth, and my fingers slide over myself, and I imagine him there, all muscle and desire to please, and I know that we are going to marry.
You write a lot about sex in your fiction. Why?
There's a few answers. The first is it's fun. I like it. I'd be lying if I said I did not enjoy it. I often tell my students when they're feeling stuck with a story to write party scenes, because party scenes are really good ways to like bring a lot of characters together, sort of cause sparks to fly, cause conflict, have some bad behavior, and can sort of launch the story into these new spaces. And I feel like sex scenes are actually very similar in that way, where you're sort of bringing people together and like creating this space where a lot of unexpected elements can occur. Mm-hmm. On this more like a sort of intimate and personal level than necessarily like a party scene. I enjoy reading about sex. Mm-hmm. Like reading literary fiction with sex scenes, it's often men, straight men, who get to write that way. And, you know, usually women themselves are sort of demeaned and reduced in this way that's not interesting or sexy. And so I decided that I wanted to write stories with women, queer women and women. They're all queer in my mind. Some of them did not have sex with women. But, you know, women having sex and just sort of living their lives and the sex sometimes being great and sometimes being okay and sometimes being bad, but being a lot of things at once. And yeah, I don't know. It's just interesting to me as an artist. And I'm really invested in it as a thing. And it's like funny because, you know, I did it and everyone comes to me and they always ask me that question, like, why do you do this? And it's like, because you have to, because you're asking that question, right? Clearly that's a space that needs filling, no pun intended.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. One of the things that I'm really struck by in your work is the wealth of concrete visual details you give the reader in your fiction. It gives your stories this really strong cinematic quality. So I'm wondering, are you a visual thinker?
I am. Actually, I was a photography major in college.
Oh, okay.
So I'm very visual. It's funny though, because I basically I'm still paying off my student loans and I just have a really nice Instagram account. That's like the way that degree has manifested, which is not super helpful to me. But, you know, I am a very visual thinker and I feel like a lot of times the way that my mind sort of categorizes things and observes things is very physical, very concrete. So I think that's just the way my brain works, honestly.
Yeah. The writer Lydia Yuknovich has said that she thinks you might have broke the mold for short story collections, and I think that your story, Especially Heinous, is a great example of this mold breaking. Can you tell me a bit about Especially Heinous?
People who love that story or absolutely hate it. Like, there's just no one feels like indifferently about it. They're just like, oh, it's the greatest story ever written, or it's terrible and I hate it, it's funny, we mentioned, to go back to the beginning of our conversation, like we were talking about Kelly Link and Magic for Beginners, the title story of that collection, is a story about television and about fandom and about sort of engaging with TV. And so I was in grad school. I probably was just watching Law & Order SVU, as I often find myself doing. And I was thinking a lot about like episode capsule descriptions, so the kind you would see on like Wikipedia or IMDb.
Yeah.
The genre of that, right? Like, what does it mean to sort of sum up like an entire episode of television? There's like a couple of sentences. And I sort of took a couple from the beginning and I tried to play around with them a little bit. So I tried to sort of manipulate them so that the existing text became sort of warped in this interesting way and sort of suggested this sort of surreal something. And I was like, I could write a whole story this way. So I sort of played around with them for a while. And then what I realized a couple episodes in was like, that sticking to the actual episode description is actually too restrictive. Like, it didn't give me enough freedom as a writer. And I also decided to like stick to the first 12 seasons of the show because A, the show is still going on and what at the time was also still going on. But I also was interested in Benson and Stabler as a sort of unit, the two main detectives in the show. And Stabler left the show after season 12. So I was like, okay, 12, it's like this perfect sort of, very biblical number.
Yeah, right. That's true.
So I decided to just like stick with the 12 seasons. I just started using the episode titles, which were all these like single words.
Oh, and those are the actual episode titles?
They are, yeah.
Oh, cool.
So all the episode titles that you see in the story are the actual episode titles. Though, funnily enough, I actually, I'm currently in the process of getting translated, and translators find typos like no one's business. And actually a translator found a typo where I don't know who did it. It was me. Somebody, at some point in the process, somebody switched a letter. And so an episode, I think the episode is called Freed and it became Greed or the other way around.
Oh,
like it
okay.
got inverted.
Right, yeah.
So that one, actually, the title's incorrect. But generally speaking, they're the actual titles from the show.
Cool.
And so I just like use those as like jumping off points
It's a very cool story. And I'm one of the kind of people, I love that story. And I think it's fair to say that with this story, you've kind of invented the literary equivalent of binge watching, binge reading. What do you think?
I definitely was sort of interested in that as a concept, because the idea of like, what does it mean to like sit down and watch like an entire show in like a day or 2 days or whatever, like that sort of feeling of like indulgence. And I sort of, I wanted to reproduce that in the story.
Let's have you read an excerpt from
Especially
Heinous.
Yeah. Honor. Stabler dreams that a man at a Renaissance fair insults Stabler's wife, and Stabler punches him in his self-satisfied face. When Stabler wakes up, he decides to tell his wife this story. He rolls over. She is gone. Stabler has never been to a Renaissance fair. Closure, Part 2. It's not that I hate men, the woman says. I'm just terrified of them, and I'm okay with that fear. Legacy. Over breakfast, Stabler's daughter asked him about Benson's family. Stabler says that Benson doesn't have a family. You always say that family is man's one true wealth, says Stabler's daughter. Stabler thinks about this. It's true, he says, but Benson is not a man.
This story reminded me a lot of David Lynch, especially with its detectives, doppelgangers, and the girls with bells for eyes. It kind of had like a Mulholland Drive vibe to me. I'm curious, is Lynch an influence on your work at all?
I love David Lynch. If I was going to pick someone whose work I was the most interested in my writing being like, he would definitely be on that list for sure.
You seem very fearless as a writer. Is there anything that you are afraid to write about?
I definitely think that I am afraid of certain topics and certain things. Like right now, I'm sort of trying to dive into one of my biggest fears, which is writing historical fiction. And I'm actually writing an entire book that's almost entirely historical fiction. So that is me sort of trying headfirst to like dive into that problem. Yeah. And I'm writing a memoir that really scares me right now that is coming out next year. And it's due to my publisher at the end of this year. And I'm really freaked out by it. So yeah, I'm definitely afraid of things. But I also think that fear, what you're afraid of as a writer, is sort of a good place to aim for. When you do that, you realize something, your brain is telling you something. If you're afraid to go for something, then you should definitely dive into it because that's where all the interesting stuff is going to be happening.
Exactly. That's especially true for the horror. There's a lot of horror aesthetic to a lot of your work, so that's especially important to do that.
Yeah.
I'd read somewhere that you were afraid of writing about race.
Yeah, that too. So I am a non-white woman who presents as white. And so my own relationship with race is something that I think about a lot. I'm interested in writing about it, but I want to do it right. I've been trying to figure it out. So one of the stories in this historical book that I'm writing does sort of deal with race in this way. And is sort of the first time I've ever sort of done that in like an explicit way. That sort of question of like, what are you or who are you and how does that relate to how you look and who you are and your identity is actually like part of the narrative itself.
You've said in interviews that you're not writing for men and you're not writing for straight people. So I'm a straight male. Do you think that means that there are things that I'm not getting out of your stories that I would if I were, say, a bi woman?
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Can you give me an example of what I'm not getting out of the stories?
No.
Okay.
There's this thing that people don't think about sufficiently, which is like everything is not for you and that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Which does not mean that you can't read something and enjoy it.
Yeah, which I do.
Right. If you're like missing stuff, you know, or there's stuff that you don't quite, you know, like a joke you don't quite understand or like a space you don't quite occupy, that's okay. Like you can just you just have to learn to be comfortable with not knowing everything and not having everything be for you.
Mm, yeah, that makes sense. You recently had a moment on Twitter where you stood up to the renowned author Junot Diaz, and you maybe even unintentionally kind of served as a spokesperson about that. Can you tell me a bit about that?
I don't really want to talk about that very much, only because, you know, I think I've said what I have to say about it. I also think it's not really about me, and I sort of want to make sure that conversation is directed toward women who specifically he victimized. You know, I had this interaction with him. It was very unpleasant. I think it said a lot about who he is as a person, as an artist. But I think I've already said everything I kind of have to say about it. So, yeah.
Yeah. And final question. You've said that every story, book, or project is a problem that the author is trying to solve. So was there a problem? Can you identify a problem that you were trying to solve with the 8 stories that make up Her Body and Other Parties?
You know, they sort of say that the first book you write, or I've heard it said, I guess, I don't know who they are, but I've heard it said that the first book you write is sort of the book that you've been storing up in your body, like your whole life, right? And like, it's all the sort of the summation of all the stuff that like you've been thinking about, you know, in your living memory and like having a space for that. And I think that this book helped me sort of answer questions about how do I exist in the world as a woman, as a fat person, as a queer person, like how do I occupy my own space and like how do I give myself that space and how do I take that space? And I figured some stuff out, which is like such a strange thing to say. It's like sometimes you go into a story being like, here's what I have to say. But sometimes you go in being like, I have a question. Like, how do I think about my body in this way? Or like, how do I talk about fatness? Or how do I talk about the husband stitch, sort of the question at the center of it is, what do we do with the misogyny of good men? And, you know, trying to figure those questions out. And I think that by writing those stories, I managed to get at some kind of thesis. And I think that's really going to help me as an artist, as a thinker, like move forward in my work.
Carmen Maria Machado is the author of the award-winning short story collection, Her Body and Other Parties. You can find out more about Carmen and her book at wpr.org/beta. We'd love to know what you think of the show. Just send us an email at beta@wpr.org.
You know, this thing was just, like, so made for my personal version of alienated, jangly, nervous New York kid that I wanted to just take it into my body.
Jonathan Lethem talks about his love affair with the album that he played until he wore out the grooves, Talking Heads' 1979 album, Fear of Music. That's coming up right after this. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. What's your all-time favorite album? An album that means so much to you that when you discovered it, you felt like the band had created it just for you. For novelist Jonathan Lethem, it's Talking Heads' Fear of Music. Jonathan writes about his love affair with the band's third album in a book called Fear of Music. It's part of the 33 and a Third series of short books about music.
My radar was up, and I was looking. By that time, I was already a little bit into the idea that there was this new music coming to get me, and I wanted it to be for me, and I wanted to identify with it, so I was perfectly ready. And when Fear of Music started getting promoed on the radio, I was listening to WNEW. That was my rock station in New York City at the time. It was with this mysterious, ghostly voice that just kept saying, Talking Heads has a new record. It's called Fear of Music. And it's like, you know, the greatest trailer for a movie that you ever saw, except there's no scenes in the trailer. It's just the title.
Talking Heads have a new album. It's called Fear of Music. Talking Heads have a new album. It's called Fear of Music.
And I think I was already ready to love this thing. And then it hit the streets. And the single in New York, of course, had to be Life During Wartime, which name-checked CBGBs and the Mud Club. And the cover of the album was really dark and forbidding, and I brought it home. And, you know, this thing was just, like, so made for my personal version of alienated, you know, jangly, nervous New York kid that I wanted to just take it into my body.
Yeah, your identification with it was so complete that, as you write in the book, you might have wished to wear the album Fear of Music in place of your head so as to be more clearly seen by those around you. What was it about Fear of Music that you found so captivating?
The tricky point of view in the lyrics, you know, that creates a kind of a persona that hides as much as it reveals. You know, you don't really know who the speaker is or what matters to them, but they're so full of attitude, this kind of thorny, alienated, self-loathing irony. And I thought, well, this is an attractive stance to wear out into the world. You know, for me then, it seemed like it was the right way to deal with being 14 years old in the middle of the 70s, or in the late 70s in New York City. I felt so at odds with everybody and everything, and the city felt very dangerous, and but also enticing. And the album seemed to create an image of a powerful response to being disempowered that I wanted to make my own. This ain't no party. This ain't no disco. This ain't no fooling around. No time for dancing. For lovey-dovey. I ain't got time for that now.
The most well-known song on Fear of Music is probably Life During Wartime. And in your book, you describe the song as voluminous. Can you explain what you mean?
One of the things that's exciting about that record, especially when you can back up, you know, as we now have the privilege of doing, is it was partly the sound of a very tentative band in certain ways, or very skeletal band with a kind of sort of thin, tinny sound in certain ways, and not made up of super expert musicians, although they'd come up with a combination of elements that was very, very interesting. But right around that time, and I think Fear of Music is the album where it's happening, and Life During Wartime is in some ways the song where it's happening, they began to discover their own power. And their power, it turned out, had partly to do with improving their own attack, becoming more competent and forceful, but also in simply inviting other musicians into the studio. I mean, one of the things about that song that's so different is there are these bongo players on it. There's these polyrhythms. Mm-hmm. Well, if you know anything about the next chapter of the story of Talking Heads, it's all about those polyrhythms and those other guys in the studio, additional drummers and bass players and backup singers thickening the sound. It's as though the very kind of lonely, alienated geek presence that had been their signature was now going to have this army of persuasive, funky sounds at its back, and it wasn't going to be so lonely anymore.
One of the things in the Life During Wartime chapter, you talk about the sturdy versatility that the song has, that it's open to different interpretations among different listeners. Can you tell me a bit about that?
What's great about a metaphor like Life During Wartime is it's so fundamental that you can kind of identify with it on a literal level or all sorts of other allegorical levels. I mean, who isn't like having a war? Like every morning, you know, getting up and getting a cup of coffee and getting my teeth brushed, that's life during wartime.
Absolutely.
On the other hand, the story seems to portray a very extreme condition. People dealing with, you know, cities melting down, and they're on the run, and they've got weapons, and there's no authority, and, you know, they're having to discard their life of comfort. You could think of this as an adolescent in high school. You could think of this as a post-apocalyptic environment, like Cormac McCarthy's The Road, or anything in between. It was versatile. It was there to be made your own.
Throughout the book, you have a series of chapters that pose specific questions, and there was one chapter in particular that posed one of these questions that I found particularly intriguing. The chapter that asked the question, is Fear of Music a science fiction record? Why did you want to explore this question?
Right at that same time, a certain kind of science fiction, like a dystopian science fiction, seemed really, really not just cool and interesting to me, but super immediate. Like, it was describing the world in a way that was urgent to me. And that was, you know, certain of Philip K. Dick's novels or J.G. Ballard. Yeah. A couple of books by a guy named Thomas Dish. And when Fear of Music came out, I put it in that framework. And Life During Wartime is at the heart of this idea that maybe this album is evidence of, you know, it's kind of a signal from a future war that's right around the corner. You know, I mean, if you were pitching it as a movie, you'd say a world just 10 minutes into the future. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the way that the environment seems to be breaking down and human relationships seem to be breaking down under the pressure of something oppressive, omnipresent and horrible on this record feels like it's telling a dystopian tale, even if you can't pin down what it is. Yeah. And I thought, you know, maybe this really was consonant with what I was experiencing, the thrill I was getting, the relevance I was sensing when I would read, like, a J.G. Ballard disaster novel.
Mm-hmm. And Kafka, too. Franz Kafka, right? You mentioned
yes.
him in that
well,
chapter.
Well, of course,
yeah.
Paranoid attitudes and
yeah.
the institutions were coming to get you.
One of your favorite songs on the album is the very last song, Drugs. What is it that you like so much about this song, Jonathan?
I mean, it's transfixing. I just find it really, on that song, more than anything else on the record, the next record by Talking Heads is sort of predicted and projected, which is to say it's got an atmospheric, mysterious, sonic quality to it that, above all, it just forces you. You know, your body's having a response to it before your mind is. It's like you've walked into a room, and the room is really different from any room you've ever stepped into before. And I really like that drugs were the overt subject. You know, I think that it's funny because everyone associates drugs with, like, 1960s rock and roll. And we all know, certainly, that the musicians were taking loads of drugs. But they rarely are addressed as a topic. Now, maybe this is partly in fear of radio censorship, right? Mm-hmm. But I also think that in some way they're being mystified by going unmentioned. And what I liked about Talking Heads' song Drugs partly was just that it matter-of-factly said, you know, wow, I've taken some and things are really weird now. That it was like putting them into real life instead of leaving them out of the frame as if they were just some sort of, you know, esoteric or almost religious.
Yeah, experience. Something mystical to reach for and kind of out of reach, yeah.
Another theme on the record, and it's a paradoxical one given all I've been saying, is it's a record about parties. But it's a record about feeling weird at the party, not being comfortable at the party, you know. And this idea emerges in Life During Wartime when he says, this ain't no party, this ain't no fooling around. But it's also in a song called Memories Can't Wait. And especially in Drugs, there's the sense that you've come to have fun and you've come to a place where you're looking to connect with other people. You know, it might be a nightclub like in Heaven or a bar, but it's not working completely, or you haven't been able to connect, or you still notice yourself too much, you're self-conscious. And so in Drugs, there's this kind of nice rhythm where the character is very present for a while, and then he sort of evaporates into mist, and you hear these birds twittering, and it's as though he's forgotten himself for a while, and he's become just a dancer or a body at the party. He's become part of almost a sort of natural order and gotten away from his all-too-present brain for a little bit.
Yeah, and as you write in the book, it's a while before we hear from the character, from the narrator, because it takes up until a minute 20 or something before we're even aware of his presence.
Yeah, it's as if the camera is in deep focus and the character is standing too close. So you see him as a blur, and you just see the room in really good focus. And then someone pulls the focus, and suddenly there's a guy there.
Yeah, exactly. And then at the end, we have the, as you write, the found speech, the some kind of PSA that anticipates the project that David Byrne and Brian Eno, who produced Fear of Music, the project they'd work on together.
There's a little bit of collage music going on at the very end of that song, and it's not one of the first things you think about with Fear of Music as a record, but it's a sort of an arrow pointing to the intense collage aspect of Byrne's next couple of projects.
Talked briefly a few minutes ago about David Byrne, about the character that he developed on these first three Talking Heads records. And this is a character that you describe as a fearful and conflicted personality. And you've mentioned that a bit, but could you tell me a bit more about that was something that appealed to you because you felt that way too?
This is the kind of appeal that derives from someone naming the things that you think you're not allowed to name. And so therefore empowering themselves or licensing themselves to become, current word might be like proactive. So if you're walking around feeling kind of alienated by, well, you know, nearly everything, and the song list is like a list of things you might be kind of alienated by, cities and parties and air and heaven and drugs and animals. Well, if you can suddenly give a name to all of these peculiar feelings, these sensations of being persecuted or paranoid or unnerved by your environment, things you're meant to take for granted, well, then maybe actually that alienation can become kind of your method or your tool. It might be a scalpel you can use to cut into the world.
Mm-hmm. Like as you described the character, as you had this great quote about being like a set of glasses you can put on and not only look through but think through. That kind of idea, right?
Yeah.
You wrote this book, Jonathan, some 30 years after Fear of Music first came out. Has all the life experience you've had in those three decades changed the way what you hear and how you listen to Fear of Music now? Does it sound different to you?
Ironically, I hear Fear of Music much more on traditional terms now than I ever could have at the time. At the time, it seemed to me Talking Heads had just invented this out of whole cloth and it made the rest of, you know, recorded music look silly. It was like, here's the future and forget the rest. Now I hear it and I think a lot about the stuff that led up to it for these individual musicians and just for the tradition.
Jonathan Leatham is the author of Fear of Music. It's part of the 33 and a third series of short books about popular music. What's your all-time favorite album? Let us know. You can just send an email to beta@wpr.org.
And so it's this completely bonkers way of assembling a story, writing it completely out of order and at various times over probably a two-year period. The scripts are really long. Like the last Gears of War script I wrote was like 1,500 pages long.
Tom Bissell joins us in just a moment to talk about the art of writing video games. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. Now it's time for Tedium with Ernie Smith.
As we move into the world of integral, computerized knowledge, mere classification becomes secondary and inadequate to the speeds with which data can now be processed. We are moving out of the world of data classification into the world of pattern recognition.
Tedium, it's the dull side of the internet.
You've got mail.
Ernie, one of your Tedium stories is called The Polyphonic Screed, and it explores the evolution of the cell phone ringtone. In the early 1980s, a British musician named Thomas Morgan Robertson enters the narrative. We probably know him better as
Thomas Dolby.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really interesting because sort of the album that he became famous on was called The Golden Age Wireless, which was a great name in reference to radio and sort of speaks to the nature of that album. Later on in his life, he actually became known for making technology that was widely used in wireless phones. One of the things that he actually helped produce with the company that he launched in the 90s called Beatnik was this ability to create polyphonic ringtones or multi-toned ringtones through the use of software. And while this could be done through hardware, which, you know, you could obviously see, for example, like if you use like a Casio or Yamaha keyboard during the era, this was actually designed so that you could, say, recreate the sounds on a web page or such. It turned out that all the companies that the Dolby worked with during this time were the kind of companies that were destined to fail due to the crash of the tech industry around the year 2000. And the one company that he still had as a client through Beatnik that didn't actually fail was this company called Nokia. And Nokia basically was looking for a solution to improve the quality of its ringtones because it was competing with other firms that were adding in chips to create like very elaborate ringtones. But Nokia, trying to save money, was looking for a software solution to this problem. And therefore, they had Beatnik. They had Thomas Dolby's company to work with. So as a result, this actually happened after Nokia created its famous ringtone, the one that everybody knows. But that actually led to the creation of a polyphonic version of the Nokia ringtone.
Okay, and so then every other major cell phone company, like pre-smartphones, licensed Dolby software too?
Yeah, companies like Ericsson and such, they all use the software. So around 2005 or so, Beatnik, which Dolby kind of started as sort of this experimental thing, became kind of a big firm.
Dolby's technology isn't used anymore, though, is it?
At this point, our phones can do much more in terms of playing audio. It's sort of like the difference between playing music on a keyboard and playing music through an MP3 player.
So in this very same story, you write this you write about this Ukrainian musician and sound engineer, this guy named Slavio Pol, and he's on working on this project to get Apple to think about using his ringtones for its iPhones instead of the ones they currently use. So what does this guy think is wrong with Apple's current ringtones?
One of the issues that he had was that these tones were everywhere. He would hear them all the time, just kind of going throughout his day-to-day.
Isn't one of his criticisms that the Apple's current ringtones have kind of the sharp sound?
Yes, and I think that it's one of those things that because it's such a sharp sound, it just kind of cuts into the day-to-day.
You
know, it's like they're just kind of everywhere making noise that is unnatural. It doesn't fit into our routines.
Have you heard any of the ringtones that he's created?
Yeah, I actually had a chance to listen to them, and I found them to be a little bit softer in the way that they kind of did their thing. There was one sound which was an alarm kind of sound that had a very intricate, like, little play between a piano sound and a guitar sound. And they felt a little bit softer than, you know, the alarms that I usually use, which ones that Apple supplies and make me very grumpy first thing in the morning.
Yeah, yeah. So do you know if he's had any success with pitching them to Apple?
He actually went to the step of mailing flash drives to Cupertino. But he has not had a lot of luck. So it seems sort of like a tough thing to pull off. He raises an interesting point, which is that these sounds that we hear every day, they're kind of decided for us by companies that are far removed from our day-to-day. And as a result, they kind of create this dissonance of sorts. I think that we as consumers, because we're the ones stuck with all these sounds, like, we need to think a little bit more about them.
Ernie Smith is the founder of Tedium, the dull side of the internet. Find out more about Ernie and Tedium at WPR.org. /beta. Video games are big business. Really big business. About $18.4 billion were spent on the video game industrial complex here in the U.S. in 2017. That's a lot of quarters. $73,600,000,000, to be exact. Tom Bissell has earned a very small portion of those quarters through his work writing video games. And when he's not writing video games, he's writing essays and books. One of his books is called Extra Lives: Why Video Games Matter.
A video game is first and foremost a piece of software, right? And they're based on systems. So I like storytelling games, you know, more than most other kinds of games. But games are kind of ill-suited to tell stories the way that I thought they were when I wrote this book. I've been writing in the video games for the last 7 years, and my thoughts have evolved and changed a lot based on my experience actually, you know, getting into the nitty-gritty of game development. But games are about systems, and they're about interactivity. So what a game will give you is a series of things you're able to do, verbs, we call them. So here are your verbs, and then you'll get goals and things that you can do using these verbs. And how you interact with the verbs in the game world and that you're given is sort of the nut of what video games can do. So sometimes the system is closed and very simple. In Donkey Kong, you run up a series of ladders to save the lady at the top of the you know, ape-ruled gymnasium.
Yeah.
In a game like Mass Effect, you're trying to save the entire universe from a murderous alien invasion. So, and that game is massive. You know, it's Donkey Kong is just a speck compared to the amount of territory you get to wander in those two games.
Yeah.
So this is just a way of saying that, you know, what a video game is as various as like what a piece of music is. You know, you wouldn't call a bluegrass banjo song, Kendrick Lamar's new album, Damn, which just won the Pulitzer Prize, you know, the Hamilton soundtrack, and like Nessun Dorma. Those are all pieces of music, but, you know, they don't have a whole lot in common with each other. Yeah.
Yeah. You talk about something called ludonarrative. What is ludonarrative?
So ludonarrative dissonance is a thing. Well, the ludonarrative itself is a term. Ludo comes from the Latin word for play, ludic.
Right.
And so the ludonarrative is the part of a game that is the story that is generated by the action of playing. So in Donkey Kong, again, the ludonarrative is the story of watching this little plumber climb up these ladders to get to the top. The narrative is that, you know, this is a story about an ape terrorizing a guy who's trying to save this imperiled woman. That's the narrative of Donkey Kong. But the ludonarrative is the things, the barrels you jump over, the hammer you grab. The ludonarrative grows out of actual gameplay.
And so there's this ludonarrative dissonance, which is the conflict between a video game's narrative and the gameplay, because in terms of the fact that the person who is playing the game has agency, they have the ability to make their avatar make different choices. Is that kind of what ludonarrative dissonance is all about?
That is part of it, but there's also a bigger part of it, which is often happens in shooters where you're the, quote, good guy and you're trying to go do something, quote, good. And on the way of doing these things, you will likely kill hundreds, if not thousands of people. And it's very hard to, like, keep in your head the fact that I'm the good guy when you're stabbing, shooting, blowing people up, you know. And so the dissonance arises from the game story telling you, hey, you're the good guy, you're doing this good thing, and the ludonarrative of, you know, I am a remorseless mass murderer just marching through hundreds of people and killing them without compunction.
Yeah.
So that's an example of the game story is telling you one thing, but the gameplay is telling you another. And I will say, having, you know, worked in the industry now for a long time, game people are getting better and better at recognizing that this is a core flaw in everything we do, and there's various ways you can mitigate it. There's various ways you can just say, well, it's, you know, if our narrative sort of doesn't jive with our gameplay, that's fine. You know, you can just sort of be silly about it.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, you've worked as a video game writer for one of the Gears of War games and probably other games. What did you learn? How did that change your understanding, that experience? How has that changed your understanding and maybe more importantly, your experience of playing video games?
Well, I guess before I started writing games, I thought that like the script was sort of written and you decided to make the script.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
But that's not how games go. That's how movies go. That's how a television episode is done. But in a game, you start with a vague sense of what the story is going to be, and then people literally start making the game while it's being written. And so what this means is you start writing a game in the very middle. Oftentimes you'll write the first scene as the last thing you'll write. And so it's this completely bonkers way of assembling a story, you know, writing it completely out of order and, you know, at various times over, you know, probably a two-year period. The scripts are really long. Like the last Gears of War script I wrote was like 1,500 pages long. Wow. And I'm the only writer on that game. So. Wow.
Why so long? Because you have to account for different options, like what reactions depending on what the player does?
No. Games in which that's an option are even longer. Gears of War is just a long game because, okay. it's a 9 to 10 hour experience. So it's like writing 9 or 10 movie scripts and there's more than, it's a co-op game. So every single bit of, every node of interactivity in the game has to have one of three possibilities, because the player can be one of three characters. So whoever like does this or walks here first, you need variants for all of those things for all three characters. So it gets big fast.
Right. Gotcha. Yeah.
So, there's not that many people on the planet who even have shipped a video game that they've written. You know, it's a form of writing that's still really new and that very few people have even done. So I find it exciting and interesting just for that reason alone.
Mm, yeah. In 2008, you were living in Vegas, and the Grand Theft Auto 4 was released, and you and a friend, you played the game with a friend for 30 hours straight. And think of all the reading and writing you could have done with this 30 hours. Was it worth it?
I'm not a person who lives with regret, and, you know, I'm 44 years old, and I've written 9 books, so I don't think I've... wasted my time.
No, you're not a slacker by any means. Yeah.
I really enjoy playing video games. Yeah. I like the experiences they give me. That was a period in my life where I was playing a lot of video games, way too many video games, in fact. But, now, I have a very healthy relationship to all the forms of media I consume, and I have a 3-year-old daughter, and that's certainly part of it is... Your time just becomes more and more compartmentalized as you go on. And those days of sitting and playing a game for hours are, not even possible for me anymore. So.
Right. And it was around this same time, correct me if I'm wrong, it was around 2008, the time when you were playing Grand Theft Auto 4, that you developed a cocaine addiction, right?
I would not say a cocaine addiction. I would say a cocaine problem.
A cocaine problem, okay.
And I sort of write about that in the last essay of Extra Lives, is this period where I realized that I've... using drugs, abusing drugs, and playing video games have gotten me to a place that was a little scary. And I kind of tried to write my way out of it with that essay a bit and, had a few more stumbles with that particular substance in the next few years, but I've happily been drug-free for a long time now, so...
Barazzaru.
What?
Good to see you, man. What? You forget our language?
There are times when I think Grand Theft Auto 4 is the most colossal creative achievement of the last 25 years. Times when I think of it as an unsurpassable example of what games can do. And times when I think of it as misguided and a failure. No matter what I think about Grand Theft Auto 4, or however I am currently regarding it, my throat gets a little drier, my head gets a little heavier, and I know I am also thinking about cocaine.
Lay off that stuff.
Why?
Because it clouds your judgment. You need to calm down with that stuff.
Calm? Why? So I can be like you?
Video games and cocaine feed on my impulsiveness, reinforce my love of solitude, and make me feel good and bad in equal measure. The crucial difference is that I believe in what video games want to give me, while the bequest of cocaine is one I loathe and distrust. As for Grand Theft Auto 4, there is surely a reason it was the game I most enjoyed playing it on coke, constantly promising myself just one more mission after a few fat lines. In Vegas and Talon, one more mission became the closest thing I have ever had to a mantra. For every moment of transcendence, there is a moment in the gutter. For all its emotional violence, there are long periods of quiet and calm.
Vlad told you to kill me, right?
Get up. Stay out of Hove Beach.
Thank you. You're never gonna see me around here again. I owe you my life, man. You're a good man. You're a good man. Thank you.
Something bombardingly strange or new is always happening. You constantly find things, constantly learn things, constantly see things you could not have imagined. When you are away from it, you long for its dark and arrowy energies. But am I talking about video games or cocaine? I do know that video games have enriched my life. Of that I have no doubt. They have also done damage to my life. Of that I have no doubt. I let this happen, of course. I even helped the process along. As for cocaine, it has been a long time since I last did it, but not as long as I would like. So what have games given me? Experiences. Not surrogate experiences, but actual experiences, many of which are as important to me as any real memories. Once I wanted games to show me things I could not see in any other medium. Then I wanted games to tell me a story in a way no other medium can. Then I wanted games to redeem something absent in myself. Then I wanted a game experience that points not toward, but at something. Playing GTA 4 on coke for weeks and then months at a time, I learned that maybe all a game can do is point at the person who's playing it. And maybe this has to be enough.
Tom Bissell is the author of Extra Lives, Why Video Games Matter. That's it for this edition of Beta. Let us know what you think of the show. You can send your thoughts in an email to beta@wpr.org. And you can become an alpha. Just follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
That's just flavor to a high life, man.
Special thanks to our technical director and music director, Steve Gotcher.
I gotta ask, do you have special equipment for this?
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
A task so simple that if the health department would let me, I'd have a monkey do it.
And thanks to you, our alphas. And until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
Once every few decades, maybe every century, a nation will produce a hero.